Good morning. John Munson in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for joining us this morning. Well, we're talking about vaccinations today. By the year 2000, measles had pretty much been wiped out in the United States. In fact, it was declared extinct, more or less. My term, not a medical term. But it's been making a comeback, and at least part of that has been because some parents have refused to have their children vaccinated. We're going to talk about why that is and why it's important, and we'll talk about vaccinations in general today. My guest is Dr. Robert Jacobson. He leads the Employee and Community Health Immunization Program and Research Initiative at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. The initiative creates a base of investigation for the study of population-based interventions to improve patient health. Dr. Jacobson, welcome to the Ideas Network.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, there's been an outbreak of measles in New York and California, and some of the blame is being placed on parents who are refusing to have their children vaccinated. There have also been reports that the virus has been passed on through medical facilities. So what do you make of all of this? I mean, we had pretty much declared the war on measles over, at least in the United States. It's still active elsewhere in the world. But in the U.S., thanks to vaccinations, we'd pretty much wiped it out by the year 2000. So why is it making a comeback?
Well, I think you hit upon several points that are, have been shown to be true in a number of outbreaks. We can identify a number of patients who should have been vaccinated who weren't. It only takes one patient to bring measles into community. Some of us don't respond to the vaccine and are dependent on what we call herd immunity. That is a ring around us of people who are immune and won't expose us because they're protected by the vaccine. The vaccine is currently given in two doses, one at 12 months and then repeated again before entering kindergarten at 4 to 6 years of age. People who put off getting the vaccine or refuse to get it really leave their children and the community at risk. And it's been repeatedly shown in the United States from measles outbreaks that have happened over the past 20, 30 years, that those the communities where they have higher rates of parents who have refused the vaccine, they have higher rates of measles. They also have higher rates of whooping cough and other vaccine-preventable diseases.
So, I mean, I remember, I still remember having measles as a child. I was born right about at the time vaccinations were just getting started. Not many people had had them. A lot of the children in my cohort got measles, and not all of them died. Obviously, I'm still here. But measles can be a very serious disease and can lead to complications which kill people.
Yes. Now particularly note the higher rates of morbidity and mortality in the young, the infants who cannot yet be vaccinated, those under 12 months of age, and we have a relatively high rate of hospitalization for those who suffer measles. Of course, the attempt to help them medically brings them in contact with other patients in the waiting rooms and in emergency rooms in the hospital, and we do all we can to minimize the disease, but frankly, parents and others don't recognize measles until it's too late, and so exposures do happen. Measles can not only leave you with a pneumonia or result in a super infection that can lead towards hospitalization. It can kill. And one of the devastating effects of measles is that it can leave you with a lifelong encephalopathy. These are rare events, and we've worked very hard to make measles rare, so these events just seem to be a thing of the past. But they will come back if we fail to vaccinate. We live in a country where we're really one plane ride, one traveler away from bringing a disease from a country that isn't well off enough to be vaccinated against these vaccine-preventable diseases. Those of us who take care of vaccine-preventable diseases, know that while we can have our population vaccinated here, travelers from other countries can easily make it into the country before they recognize that they're ill with one of these vaccine-preventable diseases and expose our children, us, others.
What is it that makes measles so contagious?
It actually is the most contagious disease that we know, and I think we'd have a hard time saying what it is about this particular virus, other than it's spread through droplets, so coughing can put it into the air, so it doesn't need to be one-to-one touch or contact, you know, skin-to-skin contact. It's most contagious before the person has developed the measles rash. So, in fact, you can't tell that you're being exposed by someone with measles until it's too late. To make it more difficult, it seems to be a hardy virus that, unlike some of our viruses that have a hard time infecting, this virus seems to do it very well. We have many other viral illnesses, but none are known to be as contagious. It spreads through a household of non-immune people where close to 90% of those exposed will get the disease.
Yeah, I was reading a story about this in the New York Times, and the respiratory droplets that someone might spread in a room can last even 2 hours after the person has left the room. So
right.
You can leave a trail of infection behind you wherever you go.
That's right. And while we make every effort to cover our cough and wash our hands with soap and water, frankly, it's very hard to protect ourselves from viruses like this just by good hand washing and hygiene. In fact, it wasn't until we were universally vaccinating against measles that we were able to dramatically reduce the incidence from 4 million cases a year in the United States to, in some years, we've had less than 100.
You, as you mentioned, the measles doesn't present itself with the highly recognizable skin rash that we associate with the disease, and so even medical professionals can be fooled. Sometimes we had the outbreak in New York City, in Manhattan, it was traced to medical facilities where the disease wasn't recognized in the early presentation stage, and so other patients became infected as well.
John, this actually points out an important problem we have with vaccinations, and it's twofold. First of all, parents, neighbors, grandparents, patients themselves don't know about these diseases because the vaccine has done so well to wipe out the memory of the complications and tragedies caused by these diseases. Vaccination becomes a victim of itself in that it's the absence of the disease is not recognized as a benefit, and so people begin to question, well, what was so bad about that disease? We have a character, Dr. Bob Sears, who has gone as far as to say, measles isn't that bad of a disease. Please don't worry about it. Don't worry about the alarmists who say this is a concern. That's one side of it. The other side of the problem of vaccine success is that our own physicians and nurses don't recognize the disease. It's not just an issue with measles, but frankly, we have a whole generation of nurses and physicians coming out of training who haven't seen a case of chickenpox. Parents who don't recognize chickenpox and will bring it into the office for diagnosis, posing a risk for our other patients. These are the problems, if you will, of a successful vaccination program that has eliminated it.
A victim of our own success. We need to take a break, Dr. Jacobson, but when we come back, I would like to talk a little bit about why some parents do not allow their children to be vaccinated, and what's behind all of that. And then I'm sure we'll have some calls and some other questions from our listeners as well. Here's how to get in touch this morning, 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. The email address, talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. And you can also reach us on Facebook. Look for the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page and leave your comment or question for Dr. Jacobson there. We're talking about the spread of vaccine-preventable diseases is coming back as some parents don't allow their children to be vaccinated, and people traveling around the world may bring back diseases that we don't see much here, and that can cause outbreaks as well. And as we just heard, sometimes even medical professionals don't recognize the early stages of measles for what it is, and we can have these little outbreaks. But we're talking about that this hour. Welcome your participation at 800-642-1234. I'm John Munson, in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network. We're talking about mandatory vaccinations for children this hour on the Ideas Network with Dr. Robert Jacobson, who leads the Employee and Community Health Immunization Program and Research Initiative at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. You're welcome to join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you had your children vaccinated, or do you not believe that vaccination is necessary or that it might even be dangerous? We'd like to hear from you this morning, 800-642-1234. I was reading an article, Dr. Jacobson, about the measles outbreak in California. In California, they have a personal belief exemption to the mandatory immunization law, and fewer than 3% of California school children actually use the exemption, but there are enough that do that the measles persist. There's a quote from one of the state epidemiologists out in California who said, "A myth persists among many parents that the measles vaccine is dangerous." That's a theme that's been repeated often in stories like this. Why is it that some people think that the measles vaccine is dangerous, and why is that belief wrong?
Well, the claim that measles vaccine and measles disease cause autism was invented by a person, no longer a physician. He was stripped of his license in the United Kingdom, name of Andrew Wakefield. He had been demonstrated to have received about £1 million to help a lawyer with a claim that children had been injured by the measles vaccine, and he created a case report, a series of 12 children who suffered from autism with gastrointestinal diseases, and claimed that he had identified a link with measles. That was published in Lancet Journal. Eventually, after repeated studies were unable to duplicate that, and no one could find epidemiologic evidence across the world in multiple studies, more than a dozen huge studies were done, including one study done in the neighboring state of Minnesota here, where we tracked the rates of measles vaccination and the cases of autism. Well, his co-authors retracted their signatures on the article, and eventually Lancet pulled the article, but the damage was done. Dr. Wakefield had seen himself as a crusader, said he was only raising questions, but frankly, all around the world, people stopped vaccinating for fear that it might be associated with autism, and led to devastating rates of measles around the world. Here in our country, we suffered with pockets of people who would refuse to vaccinate their children, and again, all we need is a small number at any one school setting or other public setting for the virus to enter into the school and then spread. If you can imagine that 95% of people respond to the vaccine and 5% don't, and then you layer on top of that another group of people, often who congregate together because of shared beliefs and shared culture, who refuse to vaccinate, and then you have travelers from countries that are suffering from these epidemics, we then have our measles outbreak. Now, despite all of the studies that have repeatedly shown there is absolutely no association of autism with measles or measles vaccine, it continues to persist. And we have parents, particularly who are struggling with an autistic child, who feel like they can't vaccinate their child or their child siblings against measles because of this invented claim.
Yeah, and I want to be careful about creating some sort of false equivalency here, because that seems to be one of the problems in the way this story has played out in the media, because there really isn't any question about anymore about this scientifically. I mean, the measles vaccine does not cause autism. We know this.
Correct.
Interestingly enough, one of the articles I was reading in preparation for this program was talking about how those people who believe that the measles vaccine causes autism and other things, when confronted with the actual facts of the case, actually their belief that their beliefs are reinforced rather than diminished. It's a real head scratcher.
It is, but frankly, we struggle with a society that doesn't trust its physicians and doesn't understand the science to interpret it among themselves. A fair number of us don't trust medicine, don't trust the companies that make the drugs and the vaccines, don't trust our hospitals, don't trust our institutions, don't trust our public health officials. Layer on to that an inability to understand the scientific method, to be able to read the scientific studies, to be able to make sense of the statistics. You've got a powerful combination of distrust and a type of scientific illiteracy that puts us at risk.
How would you counsel a parent who does not want their child vaccinated? I mean, what's the risk for their child? I mean, and not just measles, but any vaccine. I mean, if you look at it, I mean, we wiped out polio in this country by the use of the vaccine that has just saved millions of lives. How would you counsel a parent who doesn't want their child vaccinated?
Well, I use a method called the case method. I have a great deal of respect for Alison Singer, a leader of the Autism Science Foundation, who developed this approach. The C stands for really getting to connect or corroborate the parent's concern. There's no point listing the scientific studies. I really need to understand from that particular parent what their particular concern is. I then acknowledge the reality of that concern, as well as tell about me, the A part of the case method, where they really get a better understanding of what I've read and what I've studied to know what I know. You know, it's not just the parent's word against my word. The parent actually came to me because I'm an authority in pediatrics and in medicine. They actually trust my opinion in making a diagnosis of a pneumonia or treating their child's attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. I need to make sure they have that same level of understanding of my expertise with vaccines and vaccine-preventable diseases. And then I really move to the science, but it's really the S part of the case method is to summarize the science in a way that non-scientists can understand it. And then finally, I explain why I'm recommending to this particular child and the vaccination, and addressing the parent's specific concern. I know that many of my colleagues would like to just kick those patients out of their practice. I have real concerns about abandoning the children for decisions or thoughts that the parents might have. And I know that many others think, well, we should just make it mandatory, no questions asked, everyone needs to get the vaccines. But frankly, I want my parents to understand and appreciate why we're vaccinating and to be part of that decision rather than have it foisted on them.
800-642-1234 is the number to call to join the program. If you've got questions for our guest, if you would like to chime in on this this topic of vaccinations, 800-642-1234. Well, Dr. Jacobson, it has to be pretty frustrating, though. You know, you when you go through all of the years of study that anyone who's who gets to put MD after their name have to go through, and all of the things that you have to do to get to do what you do professionally, to have people just simply discount what you know to be true because they don't trust the system, that has to be terribly frustrating.
It is, but then again, I have to remind myself that I had to see measles firsthand and read about the studies of how the disease works and how the vaccine works, and over years repeatedly read the new studies to get to where I am. So I have to respect that it takes a long time to get to a place where you feel confident and comfortable with the science. I see it as my job to work with parents to get them to that same place.
We're talking about vaccinations, mandatory vaccinations. Everybody is supposed to get the measles vaccine, and it's actually it's measles. I think there are three different things, and I don't remember what they are at the moment.
Well, it comes with the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine.
That's it. That's the one. Measles. MMR, the MMR vaccine. Everybody's supposed to have it before kindergarten. Not everybody gets it. Now we're seeing measles making a comeback. Whooping cough is making a comeback in California. And a lot of that is linked to the lack of vaccinations in a very, very, very small slice of the population. We're talking about that this morning with Dr. Robert Jacobson and with you at 800-642-1234. Please join us. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about immunization this morning. There have been some outbreaks of diseases we thought we pretty much had stuffed in the box. Measles and whooping cough making a comeback in New York and California and other places around the country. Some of those outbreaks linked to parents who don't have their children vaccinated. And we're talking about that and the role of vaccination in our public health policy. Dr. Robert Jacobson is my guest. He leads the Employee and Community Health Immunization Program and Research Initiative at Mayo Clinic in Rochester. We have an email from Amy, who has a great question. We didn't get a chance to talk about this before we got to the news, but I wanted to do this right away. Amy writes, "There are a few families in our neighborhood that have not had their children vaccinated. Are my children at risk?"
The answer to that is unfortunately yes. Studies done in various communities and at various times in the United States have shown that outbreaks of vaccine-preventable diseases are much more likely to occur locally in communities where they have higher rates of unvaccinated families. It's frustrating, but it's a reality. I would argue that your vaccinating your children is an important step in protecting your children. I think that we really do depend on herd immunity, and from communities where they enjoy high rates of vaccination, we can protect those who are either not responding to the vaccine or because of their own health conditions cannot get the vaccine, or when there is small numbers of people who are unvaccinated.
Former Surgeon General Dr. Jocelyn Elders participated in a sort of an online debate at the New York Times. One of the things that she wrote about this was, when you choose not to have your child immunized, you're cheating other kids. Their vaccinations protect your child. That's kind of how it works. So she went on to say, the only exemption from immunization should be for religious reasons. Well, let's talk about exemptions. What valid reasons do you believe there would be for children not to be vaccinated?
I think if you've had a serious allergic reaction to the vaccine in a previous dose or to one of the components of the vaccine, that would be a medical basis for what we call contraindication, that you should be exempt from getting it. Similarly, if you have an underlying disease that puts you at risk if you get the vaccine, you should not have to get the vaccine. An example of that would be if you're suffering from a severe combined immunodeficiency disorder, you cannot really tolerate a live viral vaccine like the measles, mumps, rubella. You should not have to get the vaccine. So I think there are valid medical exemptions. Now, in the days of the early days of the Christian Scientist movement back in the late 1800s, when medicine was not evidence-based and where there was good cause for saying what could be offered by religion is as effective, if not more effective and safer, I think we could make a good case for religious exemption. But I think there are very few organized religions that hold that today, in modern times, that vaccination is not appropriate. And most people in the United States who claim religious exemption are actually picking and choosing the vaccines they're holding to and cannot point to any tenets in the church that they're attending that would actually back up their beliefs. I've heard of Catholic school principals who inform the parents attending their school there is no such thing as a religious exemption to a vaccine for children attending our school. I've heard similar things from other religious leaders feel the same way that the religion, as understood by those who teach and preach it, does not provide a basis for exemption to vaccine. So I would argue that in terms of school and daycare mandates, we really should look at medical exemptions.
I probably should have done this earlier, but explain to us how vaccines work.
Vaccines work at the simplest level. They take a part of the disease causing germ, sometimes a piece of the protein that our body recognizes as having being part of that germ, and allows our body to create an immunity against the entire germ, even though it's only seen that protein. So, for example, when we get vaccinated against tetanus, we're actually being exposed to a weakened, disabled piece of the toxin protein that we call a toxoid. We put a small amount of that under the skin, into the muscle. The cells around our immune-activating cells see that toxoid and create an immunity against the actual disease so that when we are exposed to the disease and its true toxins, we can defeat it before we become sick. Now, there are some situations where we give a weakened form of the entire virus. The measles vaccine is that, where it's an attenuated form of the virus that can't actually give us measles. And we give a small amount of that, again, as an injection, this time into the fat underneath the skin. Our body sees that weakened form, creates an immune response that's long-lasting, and helps us prevent a true case of measles when we're later exposed.
Now, some of the New Yorkers who contracted measles in this most recent outbreak had already received their MMR vaccine dose. The vaccine, I mean, is any vaccine 100% effective?
No. They really vary by vaccines. The measles vaccine is 90 to 95% effective, but in a country of 360 million, if everyone got vaccinated, we still have 5%, 10% who will not be protected. So we can have 18 to 36 million of us who did the right thing, got our two doses of measles, and were completely dependent on the herd immunity of everyone else. Some vaccines work better than others. We're very pleased with the efficacy of rabies vaccine. 4 or 5 doses of rabies vaccine given appropriately to an exposed person dramatically reduces close to zero the risk of getting rabies. But it has to be given, the bite has to be recognized and you have to get the doses in time.
Mm-hmm.
But we have other vaccines that we believe that every child, every adult should get every year, the flu vaccine, where we're really working with a vaccine that 50-60% effective. Now, what that means is that it will reduce your chance by 50-60%. That's not zero. That's not minimal. That's not laughable. That's real protection. And if people want better vaccine, well, we need to pay for the science to develop that vaccine, but we should use the tools that we have now to prevent the harm that vaccine preventable diseases can cause.
We're at break time. I'd like to ask our listeners to join us again, 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. If you have not had your children vaccinated, we'd like to hear why. Call in, let us know why you made that decision. If you did, why did you? I mean, what were you thinking about that? Do you have concerns? What are they? Dr. Robert Jacobson is with us, and we can try to answer your questions. We'll have a discussion, 800-642-1234. Talk at WPR.org or find the Joy Cardine Show on Facebook and leave a comment or question there. I'm John Munson, in for Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of WPR. We're talking about vaccinations this hour with Dr. Robert Jacobson, who leads the Employee and Community Health Immunization Program and Research Initiative at Mayo Clinic in Rochester. And Dr. Jacobson, we have some callers who want to join us. Ian in Waupaca is first in line. Ian, good morning.
Hi. Oh, good morning. I just want to make a comment. The triple jab MMR is not done through safety or necessity. It's done purely through convenience, and that's it. There's no reason for giving 3 jabs at once. It's just done purely for convenience. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Dr. Jacobson?
I if the caller is referring to combining the 3 different vaccines into one vaccine, he's absolutely right. It is it reduces the pain and discomfort for the child. It reduces the difficulty. If they were given at different times, they'd need to be given a month apart, so the parent would actually have to make 3 visits. So the combination is a very convenient way to get vaccinated against measles, mumps, and rubella.
But there's no, that doesn't change the efficacy of the vaccine or make it less safe or less effective?
No, the FDA here in this country, as agencies do in many other countries, requires that when we do put vaccines in combination, that they're proven to be just as safe as the individual vaccines and just as effective. Now, this is a problem because in some situations, you can't combine the vaccines. They actually alter how the vaccine works, making them less effective. There are combinations that are used in other countries that our country cannot approve because they're less effective than when the agents are given alone. In some cases, our combination vaccines actually have taken a lot more time to develop and have to take advantage of various immunologic strategies to be as good as their individual components. While we prefer combination vaccines when they exist, we recognize in many situations we just can't do it.
Let's take another call. Beth in Madison, you'll be next. Beth, good morning.
Hi, thank you. I'm calling about alternative vaccination schedules. We came across, I think it was Dr. Sears' schedule, where our children get all the vaccines, but they get them spread out more. So they may be returning to get shots like every month versus just the 2, 4, 6, etc. I'd like to know your thoughts on that.
I'm very concerned about these. Unlike the schedules that are approved by the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices through the Centers for Disease Control, Dr. Bob's Sears schedule has never been tested or evaluated. We do know that parents who delay giving the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine and give it later in life, one, leave their children longer at risk for vaccine-preventable disease. Secondly, see higher rates of febrile or fever reactions to the vaccines. And because about 5-6% of us in the ages of 6 months to 6 years run the risk of febrile convulsions, we actually see a higher rate of febrile convulsions associated with the delayed schedule. So for all those reasons, one, it's not studied. Two, it leaves the children at risk for the vaccine-preventable disease for a longer period in their life. And three, in some cases, it's actually causes more problems with reactions. I'm against those alternative schedules. One note, going back to a comment that John Munson had made earlier, Dr. Bob Sears in his book regarding vaccines mentions to parents who have chosen not to vaccinate against measles, mumps, rubella to avoid sharing that with their neighbors and others in their community, because if everyone made that decision, it would increase the rates of risk for their own children. I think people who delay vaccines using the schedules mean well, but don't understand the science that went into developing that schedule, and frankly are oftentimes choosing to delay putting their own children at risk and others.
Beth, thanks for the call. Let's go to Tom in Mount Horeb next. Hi, Tom.
Hello. Hi,
yes.
How you doing?
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm a big advocate of vaccinations. There was a time when I had the common situation where I got my first flu vaccination ever, and then later that season I got the flu the worst I've ever had. So I was kind of on the other side of the equation there, where I wasn't getting them. Finally, they talked me into them, and in the last 3 years I've received them, and I definitely had great seasons, if you will. The other piece, though, is, you know, the other side of the argument, and I just jumped on in my commute here, but is there seems to be some type of discussion on the side of the argument that all these vaccinations might cause autism. I don't personally believe that, but the question I have is this a situation where, you know, people are mixing up correlation and causation, meaning that, you know, I think maybe autism is just being diagnosed overall more, and they're correlating that, or they're falsely saying there's causation between that and the increased immunization. And I can take my comments off the air.
Tom, thanks so much, Dr. Jacobson. We did talk about the controversy about the supposed link to autism and how that was completely debunked.
Yes, but the caller makes a very good point. A lot of parents will not be aware of the fraud that went on that led to original complaint, but they will say, wow, I'm seeing a lot more autism than I remember as a child, and there's a lot more vaccination now. There's got to be a connection. Frankly, parents who have autistic children struggle and want to know what caused this, and I would point out that we've done a lot of research that points to connections in heredity and events that happened before the child was born that cause autism. Our own studies in Minnesota have shown that the increased rates of autism are best explained, as the caller pointed out, by changes in the rules of how we diagnose autism and changes in the rules of what schools need to provide in terms of services. We look at the big increases that accelerated the diagnosis of autism in Minnesota, and we can really point to the change in the rules for both diagnosis and school services. And I should go on to say that same study showed no association with the rates of measles vaccine.
Okay. We have a comment from Dory on Facebook. Good question. Are the young children of teachers at a higher risk of contracting these diseases because the teachers may be working with unvaccinated children?
Yes. Unfortunately, for those vaccine-preventable diseases where perhaps the parent did not, where the teacher is being exposed to diseases that might be brought in, there is that risk that the teacher's own children then are at increased risk. Now, the thing that the teacher can do, one, is get her vaccines, make sure that she's up to date on her vaccines. Two, make sure her own children are up to date on their vaccines. And then in terms of practicing appropriate public health measures at school in terms of hygiene, in terms of recognizing illness in the classroom, and working with parents of ill children to minimize exposure to the other school, other classmates. But yes, there would be an increased risk.
My wife, who retired after 26 years of teaching, always believed that there was a special teacher immunity that just built up over time because you were exposed to so much in the classroom that no matter what you did, you couldn't avoid. I don't know if that was true or not, but it seemed to work for her.
I do believe that teachers and pediatricians and family physicians who see a lot of the common colds do in time, having suffered the disease, then become immune to it. We know that our new medical students who then rotate through us and our pediatric rotations often will get some of these viral illnesses. We'd love to say that we have vaccines to prevent them all. It's very hard work to identify the particular virus to make a vaccine. And, in fact, in this country, most of the vaccines that are eventually developed and licensed are not adopted for routine use because we can't make the case that it would make sense to use them universally.
Well, Dr. Jacobson, if you develop the a vaccine for the common cold, I think you'll be able to retire very comfortably.
There you go. I wish I could say that vaccines are make a lot of money, and we're often accused that we do this just out of lining our own pocketbooks. Frankly, I know family physicians and pediatricians and internists across Wisconsin who would argue just the opposite. It's a labor of love. They're losing money on their vaccines that they give. It's all that they can do to break even with the costs of stocking the inventory, of administering it, of spending time counseling parents and patients without reimbursement. This is a part of the pharmaceutical industry that is a difficult one. As I said, most vaccines that eventually get licensed aren't actually put into routine use. There's a lot that goes into that decision to decide whether or not we're going to make it part of the universal recommendation. And frankly, I would say if you want to find your fortune in gold, I would not look at vaccines as that source.
All right. And with that sage advice, we'll have to say so long. Thank you so much, Dr. Jacobson, for spending this hour with us.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Dr. Robert Jacobson leads the Employee and Community Health Immunization Program and Research Initiative at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. The initiative creates a base of investigation for the study of population-based interventions to improve patient health. This program was produced by Robin Cherry, who also handled on-air production, and Christy Taylor was our director. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of WPR.